on the road or off-road, Chevy Silverado is built for tough performance in any condition. Hit the road in a new Silverado pickup. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for a dealer near you. Chevy Silverado, official truck partner of the Chicago Bears.
I don't believe I need to introduce my next guest very much. This is Dr. Tony Fauci's third appearance on this radio show, and I'm thrilled about that. As you know, he has worked for many presidents of the United States, and in a sense, I would argue, has worked for all of us as a director, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health from 1984 to 2022. The book that I'll be talking about is called On Call, A Doctor's Journey in Public Service. Good afternoon, Dr. Fauci.
Good afternoon, Steve. Nice talking to you. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, but I need to ask you a question about how you're doing. So here's what I don't understand. You are, it says on the internet, and if it says on the internet, it's got to be true, right? It says on the internet, you are 83 years old. You look 53. How do you do this?
Well, I think a lot of it is genetic. My father, who lived till 97 years old, and when he died, he looked like he was 60 years old. I mean, it's just amazing. Everything about him, he had his smarts until the last day, and his skin barely had, a few wrinkles on it. It was just amazing. So I think a lot of it is genetics, but a lot of it has to do with trying to live as healthy a life as possible. I exercise a lot. I'm a marathon runner. I don't run marathons anymore, but I used to run marathons, a lot of 10Ks, and I continually stay active physically. So I think a combination of active mentally, good genes, and active physically really kind of belies how old you are.
Well, it sure does for you. So whatever you're doing, you seem to be doing right. And I want to talk about COVID today. So, and by the way, I have, and I'll point out these questions. Shame on me. I should have said this sooner. So I posted that I was going to speak with you, and students from Wesley College Public Health students who just completed a seminar called Public Health and American Politics and Policy, they have offered some questions. I'll be asking some of those questions. I'll point them out when I do. And they are then going to discuss this interview. So I think that's
okay.
Yeah, I think that's really cool. So COVID today, the flirt variant or KP2 or KP3, what are those? Should we worry? Is there a wave going on right now? And the big question is, I ask you like five at once here, is about vaccination, because when we last vaccinated, for many of us, may have been 8 months ago or 10 months ago, or maybe you have forgotten. So when do we get the newest vaccine?
Okay, so let's take each question one at a time.
Yeah.
The predominant variants are all derivatives of the original Omicron that came about in the late fall of 2021. We had alpha, beta, gamma, delta, et cetera. But then when Omicron came, it was very different from everything else. And in fact, what it was it stayed with us with multiple variants. The variants that we have right now are really derivatives of that. And one of the things that's important is that this is not like influenza, where you have a seasonal aspect to it, where things essentially go away when the weather gets warmer. We are in an uptick now of COVID. So if you look at the number of cases now, they're all going up. That's the bad news. The good news is that there's such a degree of baseline immunity in the population from people either who've been vaccinated and boosted and or infected, so that when they do get infected, they're not protected very well against getting infected. And we're seeing a lot of infections around right now. But they don't seem to get a seriousness of disease. Some do. We still have hospitalizations. We still have deaths. But those numbers are dramatically lower than they were at the peak. But the short answer to your question is we are seeing somewhat of a wave now, mostly KP3.1.1 or KP3. If you put the two KPs together, they occupy about 50% of all the new variants. Now, your question about vaccination, definitely boosting will increase your protection somewhat against infection, not nearly as well as it does against severe disease. So if you're a person, particularly someone who's in a higher risk group, either an elderly individual or someone with an underlying condition, such as immunosuppression due to drugs that you're on for a variety of conditions, then you should definitely get boosted, which would likely be available as we approach the late summer and the early fall, right around the time that you get your flu shot. So the bottom line is, I would encourage people, particularly those who are vulnerable, to seriously consider getting a booster shot.
However, if, let's say, I received a vaccine, I don't know, 8 months ago, 10 months ago, 6 months ago, I'm not sure what the magic number cutoff is, does getting a vaccine tomorrow cover KP2, KP3, and the flirt variant, which you mentioned?
There would be some cross-reactivity that would be reasonably good, but not as specific as it would be if you actually got the most recent vaccine that matches the current variant. But if a person is at risk now and has not had a vaccine booster for a considerable period of time, then I would recommend they get the one that's available right now, rather than taking a chance.
What is the considerable period of time?
Well, you know, if you look at protection against infection, which is not nearly as good percentage-wise at all against the particular variants, that's, you know, goes away in a matter of a few months, really, like 3 or 4 months. What hangs around more from a duration standpoint is protection against severe disease leading to hospitalizations and death. But if you're 6, 8, 9 months out, the numbers go down considerably. When I say numbers, I mean the percentage of protection that you get.
Right.
So if you haven't gotten a booster 8 months ago, 10 months ago, and you're a vulnerable person, I would go ahead and get it. If you're an otherwise healthy person, I think you could easily wait until the most recent variant vaccine booster becomes available.
Which you said would be about September?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. We're talking to Dr. Anthony Fauci, of course. The name of the book, On Call, A Doctor's Journey in Public Service. We will talk about that journey. We will talk about so much that Dr. Fauci did with HIV/AIDS that many of us just don't remember, but we'll remind you when we come back on WGN. Dr. Anthony Fauci is here. I don't believe we need an introduction. I will say the name of the book, of course, On Call, A Doctor's Journey in Public Service. When that journey began, Dr. Fauci, could you have imagined that you'd ever be on the radio at one of the largest, if not the largest radio station in the country, and the host says, Dr. Fauci, he needs no introduction?
No, of course not. I mean, when I first started off, I was like so many other young physicians and aspiring physician scientists, you know, trying to do something that would contribute to the health of individuals and ultimately to the health of the nation. No, I never imagine that it would be a situation where you'd be saying something like that.
Yeah, but that's true. So here's one of the questions from a student from Wellesley College. I'm going to reframe it a little bit. So Donald Trump, you've heard of him, former president, he's running for president. Vice President Kamala Harris, she is running for president. Now, Dr. Fauci, you are too. What is your platform for public health?
My platform for public health is universal health availability, health care availability. We can't have disparities in this country where it is much more difficult for one group of people in the population to have access to health. We just can't have that. So I just think that making sure that all citizens have equity in their accessibility to health would be something that I think would be very important.
When the pandemic hit, and this is actually, you're leading into one of the student questions. When the pandemic hit, was there in this country, and maybe all over the world, a problem regarding that word you just used, equity? Did some people have more availability to vaccination or treatment than others? And of course, I would assume you don't believe it should be that way, knowing that your entire career is about helping as many as possible, no matter who they happen to be.
Well, I mean, obviously, the Affordable Care Act made things better than they were prior to the Affordable Care Act. But nonetheless, the access to physicians among individuals who are both economically deprived and those who are of minority groups generally is less than the population as a whole. So those disparities, and particularly people who not only have a disparity in access, but because of the social determinants of health, our minority populations, African Americans, Hispanics, and Native Americans, have a degree of underlying conditions that if they do get infected with SARS-CoV-2 and develop COVID, they have a much greater likelihood of progressing to severe disease, leading to hospitalizations and death. And those underlying conditions are obesity, diabetes, hypertension, chronic lung disease. There still is a great disparity despite the improvements that have occurred through the Affordable Care Act. So we need to do better. We've made some great strides, but we've got to do a lot better.
Back in the day, your association with people like Larry Kramer, playwright for a play called The Normal Heart, Peter Staley, other AIDS activists. I mean, I think that many of us, first of all, many people listening right now may literally not have been born or were too young to know that you couldn't even talk about HIV/AIDS. It was that uncomfortable. And here you were meeting with people. And at the very, very beginning, Dr. Fauci, I mean, you went to New York City, into the neighborhoods. You went to San Francisco, into the neighborhoods to see for yourself. I know because I have colleagues that were afraid to even visit people who were known to be gay because they thought they could catch this thing because so little was known about it. I mean, you go back to the point in this book on call when the disease didn't even have a name. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, yeah, it was a very, very difficult and dark period. I got involved in taking care of persons with HIV, as you said, and as I described in the memoir, before it had a name and well before we even had an etiologic agent. The first cases were recognized in the United States in the summer of 1981. It wasn't until 1983-84 till HIV was discovered to be the cause of AIDS. And we didn't have good therapy. The first therapy was in 1987 with ACT, and it wasn't until 1996 that you had triple combination of therapy that was able to successfully bring the level of virus to below detectable level and essentially totally transform in a positive way the lives of persons living with HIV. Those early years when I was taking care of scores and scores of desperately ill, mostly young gay men who had otherwise been healthy before they were afflicted with HIV were very difficult, dark years in my professional career because we couldn't do anything meaningful for the patients except comfort them and treat their opportunistic infections, which if you treated one, you might take care of it. Then a week or two later, they'd get another. And it was playing whack-a-mole until the patient actually succumbed to the disease. That was a very difficult time. It was during that time that I developed very strong relationships with the gay activist community. You mentioned some of them, people like Larry Kramer, people like Peter Stanley, Mark Harrington, Greg Gonzalez, David Barr, and all of the individuals who are pushing back against the federal government for not doing enough, but also for not including the community in the discussion about what the scientific agenda should be and understanding the rigidity of the regulatory process that did not allow more of an expanded access or a compassionate use of drugs while they were being tested in a clinical trial. So you're right. I went out into the community and met with the activists, and that was one of the best things that I have ever done in my career, because by bringing them into the fold and giving them a seat at the table and listening to what they were saying, their confrontative, iconoclastic, and theatrical behavior, when you put that aside and listen to what they were saying was making perfect sense. And that's what turned me around to essentially become an AIDS activist and to embrace the activist community in everything we did.
But, of course, you were soundly criticized for that by many. The so-called homophobics, I shouldn't say so-called, I think that's the correct term, are people who just didn't understand, and others who were more rigid in their feelings that federal government is doing what they do and we always do it right. And you said, quite literally, no, we have to not only listen but hear what they're saying.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. You know, it's understandable that the scientific community and the regulatory community, which had worked well for other diseases in their approach, but retrospectively, it was unacceptable. It was understandable, but unacceptable, because HIV/AIDS was such a unique disease that we couldn't essentially implement the established paradigms of approach because it wasn't appropriate. This was a disease that by the time a person presented himself, usually himself, we had women infected, but it was mostly young gay men that presented to a medical doctor or a medical community, that they were so far advanced that their life expectancy was measured in 10 to 15 months. So if you had an approval process for a drug that would take 7 years, that just didn't work for them. We had to do things differently. And they were right. They were correct.
Well, if that's all you did in your career, that in of itself is quite heroic. But you did so much more than that. And we will talk about some of that. We'll talk about how I think cats helped to save the day. And I also wonder, yeah, that's right, cats. And I also wonder, Dr. Fauci, if COVID is going to be with us forever. And also if another pandemic, ultimately 6 months from now, 6 years from now, 26 years from now, but at some point is going to happen. We will find out from Dr. Tony Fauci. On Call, A Doctor's Journey in Public Service on WGN. The name of the book is On Call, A Doctor's Journey in Public Service. Dr. Anthony Fauci. It's used both ways, Tony, Anthony, so I don't quite know what to say. So I'm going back and forth there, Dr. Fauci.
You can call me Tony, Steve.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. All right, so is COVID going to be with us forever?
You know, I think at a low level, it likely is going to establish itself as a low-level infection, part of the respiratory diseases that the community is afflicted with chronically and seasonally. Things like influenza, respiratory syncytial virus, parainfluenza, rhinoviruses, other coronaviruses. I doubt very, very seriously, in fact, I'm almost certain, that we're not going to eradicate it. And I don't even think we're going to eliminate it, because there's such a highly transmissible virus that hopefully will be enough background immunity in the population that people will get infected. But if they vaccinate and boost, that it will not be a serious disease the way it was so devastating in 2020 and 2021.
Well, I need to tell you a story here. So I am a certified animal behavior consultant, and I am on, among other boards, the Every Cat Health Foundation, which funds cat health studies all over the world. And at some point in time, cats get what's called FIP, or feline infectious peritonitis. It was 2017, maybe, that Dr. Niels Petersen at the University of California, Davis came to our organization and said, hey, I think I have a drug to deal with this fatal disease caused by a coronavirus in cats. And it turns out that drug really worked. The pharma company Gilead lent him the drug to do the clinical trials, much to his own surprise. It cured cats of a disease that for decades and decades and decades wasn't even understood. And then when it was, what could be done about it? Nothing could be done about it. Well, a couple of years later, the U.S. government, I happen to know, was desperate during the midst of COVID looking for something that could help. And while cats are not people, they did look at this drug that Gilead, the pharma company, had on stock called remdesivir. And it turned out that they looked at Dr. Petersen's papers, saw what it did for feline infectious peritonitis, and lo and behold, remdesivir was eventually trialed and approved for use down the road for people with COVID and helped to save lives, I believe, Dr. Fauci.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that's an example of when you do basic research, whether you do it ethically in an animal model or in a fundamental basic research way, you can never predict if and when that research will turn out to be very, very positive and productive contribution to something that you've never even heard of yet. That happens an awful lot in science, which is a very strong argument to fund fundamental basic and clinical research, because the discoveries that you make, sometimes they don't work as well for what you're originally using it for. And then 5-10 years later, you wind up finding out that you have something that really does work. So I think the example you gave is a very, very good indication of that.
And it's also a One Health example. And what I didn't say is the drug was originally created for Ebola in humans. Didn't work very well. Sitting on the shelf, help cats, helps to save cats' lives. And it turns out helps to save human lives as well. Are we going to see another pandemic of some sort, of some kind, down the road? Is it inevitable?
Steve, the answer is yes. And the reason I say that is that we have had pandemics for as long as there was civilization, pre-recorded history. And then when you go back, you see indications that there were pandemics even before we had the historical capability we have now. And then when you look at history, there have been pandemics forever. The plague of Athens in 400 B.C., you know, the bubonic plague in the 14th century, 1918 so-called Spanish flu that killed 50 to 100 million people in a world whose population is one-third the size of what it is now. So you could imagine if that happened with the number of people that we have in the world now. And then we've had flu pandemics in 1957, 1968, a more recent one in 2009, and now we have COVID. So the idea to think that with that historical background that we're not going to have another pandemic, I think is naive. So the best we can do is try to stay perpetually prepared, because a pandemic and an emerging infection is a perpetual challenge. And the only way to be able to address a perpetual challenge is to be perpetually prepared. So the question is, yes, we will. We don't know when. Maybe next year, 5 years from now, or 50 years from now. We just don't know.
But are we prepared?
Well, we're not as prepared as I would like to see us prepared. I think we were very well prepared scientifically for COVID, which allowed us to do something that has been completely unprecedented, to develop a safe and highly effective vaccine, within 11 months from the time the sequence of the virus was made known in a public database. That usually takes 7 to 10 years to do, and it was done in less than a year, less than 11 months. What we need to do better is we need to do better in our public health preparedness. We had a bit of a fractionated, somewhat discoordinated approach where states did things differently. People were making decisions about whether to wear a mask based on political ideology. People were not getting vaccinated based on whether they lived in a red state or a blue state. We should never have that type of a situation when you're dealing with public health. Public health doesn't know any political ideology. And we had a big outbreak in a very, very profoundly divisive society. So one of the ways we can help prepare, in addition to building up our local public health infrastructure, is to try and be less divisive with each other and realize we're all much more alike than we are different. And we pull together in a crisis instead of fighting each other in a crisis.
If we had done what you just said, would fewer people have died?
Oh, I think so. I mean, we already know that they've done modeling studies, and people who chose not to get vaccinated based purely on political ideology, had they been vaccinated, the estimate is that there would have been about 200,000 lives saved.
Tell me, we only have about 2 minutes left here. So in one sentence, I'm going to run by names of presidents. You tell me, because you worked with all of them that I'm about to rattle off. I won't go back to George Washington. You haven't been around quite that long. Starting with Ronald Reagan, just a sentence.
Quite a good president, but he is going to be remembered, unfortunately, for not using the bully pulpit of the presidency to call attention to the emerging outbreak of HIV in the first year of his presidency. He could have done better. He had so many other good aspects about him, but if he had been out there speaking out and warning about HIV/AIDS, that would have been much better for his legacy.
George H. Bush, first Bush.
The first Bush, I think, as a real wonderful gentleman who I developed a very, very good and close relationship with, showing you that whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, that he had a high degree of integrity and a great deal of respect for the institutions of the government.
And empathy, from what you wrote in the book. President
yes.
Clinton.
You know, a brilliant person, made some really good things that he did. One of them was to work with me to put together the NIAID Vaccine Research Center, which was originally built for HIV/AIDS, which actually played a major, major role in the development of the COVID vaccine.
George W. Bush.
You know, a real hero in HIV/AIDS, because he asked me to be the principal architect of the PEPFAR program, which he was a great, great supporter of. We established the program. He announced it in the State of the Union on January 28, 2003. And 20 years later, that program has saved 25 million lives. So President Bush, you may have disagreements with him in other areas, but his leadership in getting the PEPFAR program off the ground has literally saved 25 million lives.
President Obama.
You know, a brilliant person who had the situation where there were a number of outbreaks during his presidency, the pandemic of 2009, Ebola and Zika, an absolutely brilliant intellectual who was very easy to work with.
President Trump.
Well, you know, I mean, in the beginning of the COVID, I didn't get to interact with him literally until the last year of his presidency. Things got off to a good start. We got along very well. But then when he started saying things that were just frankly not true, like the virus was going to disappear like magic, and then when that didn't happen, saying that drugs like hydroxychloroquine were the magical cure, when there was no evidence that it was. In fact, there was some evidence that it was harmful. I had to publicly disagree with him, so I had somewhat of a difficult relationship with him, because that's the first time in all of the years that I've dealt with seven presidents that I had to have the uncomfortable situation, and I didn't relish it, that I had to publicly disagree with the president of the United States.
President Joe Biden.
Joe Biden, just a terrific person. I've known Joe Biden for years and years during his vice presidency and when he was the senator. You know, he really got the vaccine implementation program right off the ground, resulting in the saving of a lot of different lives, a lot of lives. So I have a great deal of respect for President Biden.
A lot of lives saved. That's what you've done. What a career. And you've been rewarded for it in many ways, but maybe not enough somehow. On Call, check this book out. Dr. Fauci, you don't dumb it down, but yet you explain medical stuff in terms we can all understand. On Call, A Doctor's Journey in Public Service. Dr. Tony Fauci, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Steve. Great to be with you.